I come down here every day for that. Good evening, friends. My name's Frank Honeycutt. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's good to be here, and I'm happy to know that I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad you people are here. And I've got a bad report for those people that are new that didn't stand up. I want you to know that we know who you are. And that we're going to turn you in to headquarters if you don't stand up the next time. That is, if we can find out where headquarters is. I came down here with a good-looking girl, I'll tell you that. Diane, I stood out on the corner for a long time looking for somebody to come with me. And she finally believed my story. Diane's a terrific entertainer, and she's a vocalist. And we had a big party in Long Beach at the Ice Cream Social for Central Office on the 18th of April, and she and her band were absolutely dynamite. So one of these days we'll have a fling-ding down here and have her do her stuff. You know, I love this meeting. I love this meeting, and I have an awful lot of friends in here. People have known me as long as I've been around here. And people that I have gotten where I know and love. We're the luckiest people in the world. We're the absolute luckiest people in the world. Have you ever stopped long enough just to think, well, why? Why was I given this thing? And everybody in here has thought about that except the brand newcomer. And their thought is, God, what have I done to warrant this? Kind of reminds me of kids coming into, new people coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Reminds me of a story that was on internet this last week. It seemed that there was a family that had these two boys, and they got into everything. They were Pat and Mike, and man, if trouble was around, they were in it. And they didn't know what to do with it, and so the mother finally told the mother, said, you take those boys down to talk to the priest. And they did. And the priest said, I'll see them, but I want to see the young one first. So the priest brought the kid 10 in and set him down across from his desk, and it was an empty room, and the kid was nervous as could be, and his feet were flopping and moving in the chair, and the priest looked at him across the table and the desk, and finally he says, where is God? And the little boy did not have a response for it, and he waited for a while, and he made this statement, where is God? The kid sat there, and the priest kept looking at him, and finally the young man jumped down and ran out that door. He went home, and he passed his big brother, and he said, come with me. And they went up to the hall, to the closet, that they used as their plotting room, where all of their deals were planned out. And he told his older brother, we're in deep trouble. Big trouble. He said, why? He said, we're in deeper trouble we've ever been in. He said, why? He said, God is lost and they think we have something to do with it. That was just right. Right amount of vodka in there. You know that membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is the most precious thing that we people have. Far and away, will exceed anything material that we have, and And the things that we love, we would not have had them if we hadn't gotten sober. I have talked to old friends here, and oftentimes the only thing we end up with is sober. And sober is as high as we get in here. As high as we get. This is this was a humbling thing for me to find out. I thought that if I come here and do certain things and curtsy to Clancy and do a lot of those things that I might be elevated above sober. But hell, he hadn't made it either. He's just still sober. Coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was the most humiliating thing that ever happened in my life. I did a lot of humiliating things. I'm retired from the Navy. And as I look back, when I was 14, I was an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic and I came from Arkansas. That's enough to make anybody troubled. And I was the last of seven children, and my father and his father spent some 70 years in a courthouse in Saline County, Arkansas, and both of those gentlemen were alcoholics. I was the last of seven children, and all of us were alcoholics. So this is no mystery to me, but it was when I came here, because, of course, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. We expect far too much of our newcomers. When we bring them into Alcoholics Anonymous, we think that we can come in and lecture them and let them sit down and attend some meetings, and then we want them to immediately say that they're alcoholics before they know what an alcoholic is. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is a man or a woman that whose body cannot assimilate and eliminate alcohol the same way somebody else does. But then we expect every newcomer to know that, and they expected that of me. So that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to please my wife. I came with the heat on. I have since found out that Alcoholics Anonymous will be 63 years old the 10th day of June, and that we've never ever had a volunteer. Nobody has ever awakened one day and snapped their fingers and said, Boy, the world is right with me. I think I'll go down and join AA today. We don't get anybody that way, do we? We get everybody, and you, the newest newcomer in here can recognize this, and everyone else will affirm it, that everybody that has ever come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we come here with the heat on. It was bad out there that day, wasn't it? It was bad. It was worse, and then it got worse, and then, as Singing Sam said, it got worser. But then we get in here and we fight this thing. We fight it tooth and nail. And then finally the day comes that we have a moment. Father Leo talks about having a moment. And when we have that moment, the magic happens. The magic happens, and we can see clearly. There's a line in the Bible that says, we see through the glass darkly. But then in here, we get to where we see clearly that one moment. And that one moment, we recognize, yes, I'm an alcoholic. And if I follow and do the same thing these people are doing that I'm hanging around with, perhaps the good things that have happened to them will happen to me. And that's down the line. It won't happen, as Bill wrote in the book, let's not get too good by Thursday, because it ain't going to happen that way. But it happens, and it happens over and over. I'm just reading Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age Again. That's almost an unpublicized book in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's the most exciting literature that we have. Far more exciting than the big book. because it tells the story. It tells the story of how you and I got here. How you and I were privileged to be a part of this. Alcoholics Anonymous, until Bill and Bob got together on Mother's Day. It's ironic that today is tomorrow's Mother's Day. Because would you believe that they met on Mother's Day in 1935. Bill wanted to meet him on Saturday before Mother's Day, but Dr. Bob was a good man. He was a good man. He suffered. He was a drunk, is what he was. He was a good husband, like so many of us are on those holidays. He stopped by the florist on his way home and he bought his wife a nice potted plant. And he took it home. And he set the potted plant on the dining room table. And then he was potted and he fell under the table. A lot of us have done that on Mother's Day, haven't we? We've done it at an inappropriate time. So when Bill Wilson, when Henrietta Seidelin called to tell Ann that there was a dude from New York that was out there that had a solution to a drinking problem, and he wanted to talk to Dr. Bob and wanted him to come out right away, and Ann said, "We can't come today. We can't come today." And she went on to explain to Henrietta why they couldn't come. But then Henrietta extracted a promise from Ann that they would come tomorrow, that they would come on tomorrow. And the next day when Bill was driving out to Henrietta's, to the Goodyear estate, when they were driving out there, Dr. Bob looked at Ann and said, "I'm going to give this dude 15 minutes, no more. And when I say we're going, we're going. We're out of here. I don't feel like talking to him. I can agree with him, can't you?" And they got there and they met at 5 o'clock. And the 15 minutes lasted until 11 o'clock. Dr. Bob went home, and you know who he took with him? Bill. He was, happens a lot in AA. He came for 15 minutes and took the speaker back with him, and he lived with him for 4 months. And they did nothing but talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. They did nothing but talk about the Oxford group. They did nothing but talk about one drunk talking to another. Bill told Dr. Bob why he wanted him. He said, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drunk, and I need to talk to someone. And he had discovered in the 6 months since December, when he'd had his last drink, he had discovered that when he talked to other people about their drinking, about his drinking, that he didn't have to drink. He became disgusted, as many of us are, when we're working with new people and nothing happens. It seems that they don't hear us. They don't get this thing. They don't follow our directions. It seems that we become that disappointed and disillusioned. And Bill told his wife that this thing don't work. It don't work. And she said, "Well, yes, it does." And he said, "I've talked to these people for 6 months, and nothing has happened." And she said, "Oh, yes, it has. You haven't had to take a drink. So this is our need for the newcomer. Don't you think for 1 minute that we don't need the newcomers far more than they need us? Because you see, we have found the secret. We have found that we need the newcomers. The newcomers have lived up until now without our help. And they will go on and live until they do whatever. You see, religion started some 5,000 years ago. Zoroaster, he had the first little camp meeting, I guess, 5,000 years ago. And they talked about the evils of alcohol, and it seems that I had heard about that all that 5,000 years. But then nobody was getting sober. Nobody got sober until the 10th day of June, 1935, when Bill and Bob finally decided, or Dr. Bob decided on that day, that he was going to embrace this fellowship, the fellowship that wasn't even a fellowship, the fellowship of the Oxford group, the Oxford movement. This is why we say today that I'm Frank Honeycutt, I'm an alcoholic, or I'm Frank, I'm an alcoholic. We wanted to differentiate ourselves from those other dudes that were in that meeting, that were in there for religious purposes and just living the good life and trying to do good for other people. That was their really mission in life. It was the nearest thing to first century Christianity that there's ever been. But then the alcoholics that started this thing and started rebelling in Cleveland first and then in New York, they got to where they would go to a meeting and they would meet with the regular members of the Oxford group, that they would go on and do whatever they were doing. But then the alcoholics, the people with a drinking problem and didn't have a smidgen of religious consciousness about them, they wanted to differentiate themselves and say, "My name is Frank, I'm an alcoholic." They could have probably told them that they were alcoholics without opening their mouths. But then this is how we started doing that. We wanted to let people know what we were doing. So that, thank God that Alcoholics Anonymous was here. Thank God that Alcoholics Anonymous had been founded just, how many years ago? 63 years ago. 63 years ago today was when the first conversation took place. And then tomorrow is the day that they met. So this is a hallmark, if you will, that why you and I are able to be here and why people in India and Africa and China and wherever the human tongue is talking, there's a possibility that Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be there. And there is no dues or fees. There is nothing for us to do except to give of ourselves and to love one another. The nearest thing that can possibly happen to you and I is to resolve within ourselves that that I'm going to do better. Yesterday's thought for the day in Daily Word said, if you trust God and do good, God will grant all of your wants. That ain't a bad deal, is it? If you trust God and do good, God will grant all of your wants. It's something that we didn't expect, was it? And I want to get out of here because my name is not Reverend Frank, I'll tell you that. But I'll guarantee you that without a clear and distinct understanding that this is a spiritual program, that we're as lost as a ball in tall weeds. That we can hang around here forever and ever, we can memorize that book, and we can write journals and ledgers and make pledges and pleads from now on, and until we have a spiritual experience of some kind, then we can't have this thing. There is one requirement and one requirement only in that big book. In order to be able to make this program, it says, do you believe in God or are you willing to believe in God? Do you believe in a power greater than yourself or are you willing to believe? That willingness is all that we need. And then we go on and start living our lives at the dictates of the group. Because in this group, this is where the power is. The power is in here. This is a church. The church has been here forever. The power is of recovery from alcoholism is right in this room, and you people brought it. you brought your share and everybody else brought theirs. We come down here to chat and to hug and to shake one's hand and to meet and greet newcomers. And this is where the recovery is. This is the total place of recovery. Make no mistake about it. This is why we continually say, keep coming back. Keep coming back. The miracle is here. Keep coming back. And that time will come, that moment will come, that electric moment will come. And oftentimes it will come when it's least expected. That I think that I have this. I think I understand this. I think I'm going to do this one day at a time. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on our 19th wedding anniversary. It was the 17th of August, 1963, and as I said, I'm retired Navy, and at that time, I was a real estate broker in Long Beach. I had owned a cocktail lounge and had done an awful lot of things, and all of them had very close to alcoholism. I had been out on a safari on the 17th of August, and when I woke up that morning and came into the house, when I drove into my driveway, I had my first lucid moment. A lucid moment or a moment of clarity, and I don't like to talk like this from a podium, but then I almost have to in order to get my point across. The day that I turned into my driveway on the 17th of August, I had that lucid moment. That a lucid moment in the eyes of a practicing alcoholic is when you realize you're in deep shit. I had that lucid moment as I turned into my driveway because I had been gone from home for a day and a half or so. And as I turned into my driveway, I remembered it was our wedding anniversary, and I didn't have a bouquet of flowers, a box of candy, a card, I had nothing but a bad breath. When I opened my living room door, my front door, and I walked in, and here stood that future member of Al-Anon standing there. You know what she looks like because you have one. She didn't know whether to get a knife and cut my throat or hug my neck because she was crazy. And you know the reason she was crazy? I had driven her there. She was a lovely young lady that I had put through the rigors of hell. And I was trying to be nice on that particular day. Instead of me hollering and in a boisterous voice and letting her know if she would straighten up and pay more loving attention to me and keep a good clean house, that I wouldn't have to go out and drink. Boy, we'll blame it on the Empire State Building. Instead of me raising hell with her, I told her I was sick, something that none of you people would ever think of. I was searching for some tender, loving care. And instead of Virginia saying, Frank, let's get in the car and run up to the Navy hospital, she said, Frank, would you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Whether you know it or not, whether you've gathered it, I at that time thought I was the smartest man that I had ever met. You know, that there was nothing that I didn't know. And she was certainly not going to tell me anything. But then do you know that when she said, would I go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said yes, and I'd never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it shows how smart I was, or how lack of information that there was in the news for in 1963. I called central office and they asked if I knew where Locust Avenue was. I was a broker, so I knew that. Then she said, do you have transportation? And I thought, yes, I have a new Continental. And it didn't impress her any more than it just impressed you. When Virginia drove me down there and I got out of that old building across on Locust Avenue, I looked at an 8-story building, and I thought to myself, well, you see, we people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we do a lot of silent thinking, don't we? we should have said, and I could have said, I thought then, God, if you're going to join something, I wish you'd had a little more class than this. And I thought even more of it as I walked through the lobby of that old Masonic temple and got up in the elevator and up on the fourth deck walking down that passageway. The thought then came to me, well, I can see they could use a good Navy chief in here to get them straightened out. And when I turned into central office, this lady said, may I help you? Back again, silent communicating. I thought, honey, with a voice like that, you can't do nothing for me. And she didn't pay any more attention to me than nothing. She reached on her desk and handed me that buff-colored card that 20 questions and said, here, you sit on over here and take this test. And she immediately started selling Virginia books. And let me tell you, she had a ready buyer. I took that test very rapidly and I brought it back and I handed it to Helen, and she glanced at that and said, well, you're sure in the right place. I don't know how in the hell, you know, she didn't even have a pen in her hand. But then newcomers, and I know you're here, I'm going to save you some embarrassment. At the bottom of that 20 questions, read that fine print. It's incriminating. It says if you answer one yes out of that 20 questions, you got a problem. If you answer two yeses, you got a bunch of problems. If you answer three or more yeses, you're a dead stinking fish. It don't say that. It says that if you answer three or more yeses, you're an alcoholic. I'd have rather been a dead anything than an alcoholic, and I didn't even know what it was. So that she told me I'd be happy to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we just don't drink one day at a time. And she had a smile on her face all the time she was talking, but the curtain came down. And I knew I couldn't do it. I knew I couldn't go a day without drinking, and that was it. There was a gentleman that had come from somewhere in standing in central office. It was as if Mandrake the magician had put him there. He was bodily standing there, and he touched my shoulder, and he said, Frank, my sponsor told me we don't have to stop drinking a day at a time. You know my antenna went up. Well, I wanted to hear what he had to say. He said, my sponsor told me we don't have to stop drinking a day at a time. We just don't take a drink right now. You know, that hit my pygmy brain just right. I went over and kicked Virginia under the table. I said, let's get the hell out of here. I know how this works. We learn fast that first day, don't we? I held her books going home, and I thought to myself, I sure hope she enjoys reading these. This is the neatest anniversary gift I've ever given her. I got home, and I had a cupboard full of booze, and I remembered what Mel had said. We just don't take a drink right now, and I didn't drink any that afternoon or looked out the window about 3 o'clock, 3:30, and up my sidewalk came a well-groomed young man. He was wearing a suit, coat and tie, well-dressed, and he had a whole head of hairs enough to irritate me. He rattled my front door and said, my name is Bud, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous, can I come in? And with that, he was sitting in my chair. And he was crazier than a woman was at Central Office. He said, you'll give me this tickle to death to be in Alcoholics Anonymous where we have banquets and roundups and powwows and we drink coffee and we eat donuts. And I thought, you poor bastard.
Turn the tape now, please.
Here, I'm sick of a billy goat and you want me to eat a donut. He asked me if I'd go to a meeting with him, and I said, yes. I knew if I got him out of my house, I wouldn't let him back in. But our memories are short along with everything else, and that evening he came by and picked me up. And I got in his car. That was mistake number two. And Virginia came along, and He drove us up to Signal Hill. To Signal Hill, and there's nothing in Signal Hill right now. This was 35 years ago. Thank you. This was 35 years ago, and there's certainly nothing improved since then. But then when I drove by the meeting, met in the old city hall, the basement, and when we drove by, had double doors and had a sign hanging down, standing up with a light on it, and I thought, why don't they take that sign in or turn that light off? Somebody could see you walking in here. God, we wouldn't want anybody to think we were going to do something about our drinking, would we? I got in there, and everybody's gathered around the coffee pot. Much of the same as here tonight. Everybody's around the coffee pot. Everybody's talking, and nobody's listening. And before I knew it, they handed me a cup with a handle on it. This was in 1963, and would you believe in 1963 they didn't have styrofoam? They handed me a cup with a handle on it, and before I could say, I don't want that, I don't want nothing, they'd handed me that cup and a handle on it, and I hadn't had a drink all day. I shook it dry, absolutely dry. I was as nervous as a good girl in a bad place. I wanted to bolt out of there right then, but they started the meeting, and they seated me on the second row, between my wife and the donut eater. And the guy did all of the talking that had been doing up until now, and it was a participation meeting. They did the reading, and they didn't have a coffee break or a smoke break. But then as soon as that reading stopped, they had a little lull in the monotony. I got up and headed to the back, and the coffee maker, Frankie, was that broad. And as I headed back to the back to get out of that place, Frankie started down the aisle. And I thought, God, what's going to happen? And I explained to her that I was a retired naval officer and that I had a nervous stomach. I suffered from claustrophobia. I had a heart condition. What I had to do was go puke. And I did. And they, much the same as this, they had a sink at the back of the room. And after I'd done that good job, I come in, I threw water on my face and up on my bald head. The lint stuck up here. And I told that coffee maker, you go get my wife and that donut eater so I get the hell out of this place. That was my first meeting. And I lasted just past the fifth chapter. I went home, I remembered what they had told me, and I didn't take a drink. I didn't take a drink that night. And I went to a meeting the next day, and I went to a meeting every day for the next 35 days. I went to work, and I did not take a drink. I honestly believe that anyone can stop drinking the first time. The first time, it seems that is God-given. The ability to stop drinking the first time. I didn't drink for 35 days, but I had no more intention of going the rest of my life one day at a time without taking a drink than I had of flying. I wanted to stay here long enough to convince her and anybody else that was nosy enough to stick their nose in my business that I wasn't an alcoholic. And somewhere along the line, 35 days seemed to be the magic day for me. I had this weekend planned, and I left my home group, the Los Alamos group, after the meeting. I left at 10 o'clock and headed right up to the Eldorado. During that period of time, I'd earned the nickname of Reverend. I was so clean living. And I walked in, and the manager said, "My God, here comes the Reverend." I said, "The Reverend is drinking tonight." And I intended to drink Friday night and Saturday night. And on Sunday, I was going to quit drinking. I'd quit on the 17th of August. It would be a peach cake. So that the weekend went splendidly. Would you know that Friday and Saturday night just worked beautifully? But Sunday, the day I was going to quit drinking, the wheels came off. That's when I found out that I was an alcoholic, and I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. Found out that the day that you drink and you don't want to drink, the day that you drink and you promise that you won't drink, you're an alcoholic. You're an alcoholic, and there's no return. There is no return. Once we find out that we're an alcoholic, there's never any ability to go back and drink again. The disease of alcoholism is progressive from that day on, and it will become more critical as the days go on, whether you're drinking or sober. But then once you start drinking, then I couldn't stop. I continued going to a meeting every day. I went to a meeting that Sunday, and I took the manager, Bowtie Sid, the manager of Rouse Market, with me. He had been sitting around drinking with me all Sunday and probably the rest of the weekend, and I mentioned I was going to go to AA, and Sid said, "I sure am glad I don't have to go to that." And I thought to myself, if I'm an alcoholic, boy, you're really bad. You're going to go too. And I took him. You call that misery like company. I took Sid to it. We got there late, like good drunks do at AA meetings. We walked in the back of the room and knocked over some chairs and pushed tables around and talking out loud, and the speaker's up here talking, and everybody's turned around to look at the clowns in the back of the room. And on the way out, Sid said, "Honeycutt, I'm not going any more than any AA meetings with you." I said, "You can bet your sweet ass on that, man. You make a spectacle of yourself." Boy, we're going to blame it on somebody. I took Sid home and took Sid back to the bar. And I guess we closed the bar. But I continued going to AA meetings. And I went to AA meetings every day. Every day. But I had to drink every day, too. Because at that time, I couldn't stop. And if you've been there, you know. If you haven't been there, I could talk to you from now on, and I would never be able to make you comprehend that we don't just stop drinking when we decide we're going to stop. As I said, I attended a meeting every day, and during that period of time, I don't know what I was thinking. I really don't know what I was thinking. I know that I carried on a business, and it was the business was doing all right. I had 8 or 9 real estate salesmen working for me. I had a business opportunity office in Long Beach, the largest one that was around, and it was very successful. I went to meetings, and I got to where I knew everybody there. I knew everybody wherever I'd go. I met everybody wherever I would go. And I'd go to these meetings, and I would usually get there late, and I would leave as soon as the prayer was over. But then somebody would sidle up to me and pat me on the shoulder and say, "Honey, you just keep coming back. It's going to work for you, and this too will pass." Boy, wasn't that a nice statement. I was beginning to think it was going to pass out my eyebrows, eyelids, or what. But then those people were kind, and they were helpful, and they were undemanding. They just wanted the best to happen for me, and we get to where we understand that. They want to help. They don't want anything back. So during that period, I was going and I was having to drink, and I was not getting home for dinner. During that 35 days, I didn't miss a night going home for dinner, having dinner with the family. I had a daughter that was 14 and a son that was 8. And Kathy had witnessed this 35 days, and she wanted so much for Dad to be able to come home from the office to sit down and have dinner and to be a family. And it wasn't happening. I woke up this one morning, and Kathy was in the breakfast nook, and I seated myself at the table, and Kathy was standing in the doorway, right at the door facing. She was a little girl that stood 4 feet 10 inches tall, and a little towhead, and she wore glasses, and her face had turned bright red, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. It seemed that there was a father-daughter banquet that night, and Kathy wanted me to take her. And she said, "Dad, please don't drink today." And I immediately told Kathy I won't. You see, Kathy was the apple of my eye. Yeah, I would have hung the moon for her if I could. So Kathy had a lot of surgery, and she was just the most beautiful person in the world, and I loved her so much. And I immediately told Kathy, "I won't drink today, Doc." And then Kathy asked me, she said, "Dad, would you say that on the Bible? This is something we didn't do in our house." But that morning we did. Kathy turned and walked into her bedroom and came out with a little New Testament, and I looked her in the eyes and I said, "I won't drink today, Doc." And then Kathy looked up through a veil of tears and kind of smiled and turned around and walked into the bathroom and washed her face and walked off to school. When I left the house to go to the office, I had to stop at the bank, and I drove behind the bank as I did two or three times a week, and I parked my car. I got out of the car and got almost to the door. I then remembered that I had a bottle of vodka under the seat. The reason alcoholics buy electric seats is so that they can put a bottle under the seat and let the electric seat go all the way down on the bottle. Then if you have an accident, the bottle won't fly out. I had my bottle stashed in that secure place, and I raised the seat of the car, and I got that bottle of vodka out, and I drank it like I have to take my next breath. And when I did, I sat there then and looked at that bottle. And I said, "Why do you have to break another heart? Why do you have to lie? Why can't you be a man? Why don't you turn over a new leaf?" And of course, I started drinking. And I didn't get home for the banquet. Didn't get home for the banquet that day, and when I did come home, I had no answer. We don't have an answer, do we, when we've broken another heart and another promise. This is the life of an practicing alcoholic. And we don't know it. We can't help it. That wasn't the last drink that I took. The day before Easter, not too far down the line, I had been out on another one of my safaris, and I came in that Saturday morning just as Virginia was leaving. And Virginia had started going to Al-Anon, and let me tell you, they have a good release program in there. I stopped her and I told her, "Virginia, you don't have to leave because I'm not going to drink this weekend." And Virginia faintly smiled at me and said, "Frank, we know that you're not drinking because you want to. I hope that tomorrow you'll be able to come up to Glendale and have Easter dinner with us." And with that, she drove away. I'd heard Chuck talk from the time in August when I first came until that March. I don't know how many times I'd heard him, but Chuck always used this gesture. He'd make the statement, "I've been as sober as I am right now between ever two drunks." And that he'd talk about sipping himself into bed. And then he would have to die and walk and freeze and die in order to start to live again. I went into my house and obviously nobody was there. They'd just left to go to Glendale. And I started walking through my house, and I don't know what prompted it. If I had had anything to do with it, I guess I'd have called the neighbors in for an audience. But I was walking through the house, and I found myself kneeling at the foot of my bed. And I said a prayer along this line: "God, you know I've been going to those meetings. If you would help me to get sober, I'll do whatever I can for Alcoholics Anonymous." That was the 28th day of March, 1964, and until today I haven't had to take a drink. And I can't take credit for one day of it, because all I did was come in here and I started doing what people were doing to stay sober. I went to a meeting every day. I still go to more than a meeting a day. I've been sober in Long Beach. We started in Hawaii, but we count days that we've been sober in the harbor area now. And not that any of you people would be interested, but today I have 12,458 days, and that includes leap years. I'm glad you finally did that. I think you need the little levity. Applauding an alcoholic for not drinking is just like applauding a rodeo hand with a bad case of hemorrhoids for not riding a bucking bronc. We don't drink now because we just can't drink, that's all. So there's no credit given. I went up there that day and went to Glendale that day, and I made a trip to the Alana Club and met Barbara at the Alana Club and at the Windsor Club in Glendale. Never met her before, but she was the only lady in there that day. And I went in and I told her my story, and she got up out of her chair and hugged my neck. And she said, "Frank, you'll be all right. Everything's going to be all right." I went back home and back down to where those people were drinking and having their Easter dinner and a good time. And I left there and I went to Long Beach that night. And I went to a meeting, and I've gone to a meeting every night since. This is the best deal I've ever had. Taking those 12 steps is the program of recovery, and I was hung around here a long time before I took them. It seems that 34, 35 years ago, we were not talking as much about taking the steps. Then I wasn't, as we do today. To take the steps, the only reason that people don't take them is because nobody's there to work with them. The only reason that newcomers do not take the steps is because they don't know how. People are not working on a one-to-one basis with them. They don't know how. The first thing that we admit that we're powerless over alcohol, that our life is unmanageable, and that's awfully simple. That's real simple to do. All that you have to do is, if you are not convinced yourself, ask the people that you live with. They'll let you know that you're an alcoholic. And they'll be quick to tell you. They'll remind you often. The second step, we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Now this implies, it implies that you're not dealing with a full deck, or that your chimney is missing a few bricks. That the things that we do, if you think that you're not insane, think of the last drunk that you were on. You didn't wake up entering class, did you? The third step is so important. We make a decision. The first, second, third, sixth, and seventh step is only a decision. Now, you can write about them from now on, but if you admit that you're powerless over alcohol, I don't know how you can be more convinced. What I could ever write that would make me more convinced that I'm an alcoholic by writing. So if you're an alcoholic, you know it, don't you? If you'd better hope that you're an alcoholic if you act the way you acted in step two. You'd better hope that you're insane and that somebody's going to make you better. The step three is we have a prayer that we make a decision. The power of recovery is in this room, and that prayer is applicable to everybody that's here. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as I will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? That I may better do thy will. that I may do good. Take away my difficulties, and God, we had them, didn't we? Take away my difficulties. Why? That victory over them would bear witness to the people that I'm going to work with. Will show your power and your love and your way of life. May I do thy will always. This is a decision. The only thing that it requires now is action. If you love somebody, show them. Don't whisper it. Show them. Do. If you want to do have self-esteem, you do esteemable things. And you know what they are. Help somebody take their fourth step. It isn't bad. It's a moral inventory. It isn't an immoral inventory. So that you have two or three things that you resent, two or three things that you are fearful of. You have two or three things that you're fearful of, and you have a couple or three dozen sexual things that are bothering you. And all you have to do is sit down and have to talk to somebody about it. Well, you haven't done anything that anybody else hasn't done. And you know the irony is the disease of alcoholism. We think that we're the only people who've ever done it. You know, I had a man when I was probably 11 years old, 10 years old, maybe 9 or 8 years old, that showed me about masturbation. You know, I thought that Harold Ballard was the smartest man in the world. And I was like the boy that his mother caught playing with himself and said, "You've got to stop that. You've got to stop that. And it's going to make you go blind." And the kid kept doing it the next time, and the mother said, "I told you to stop that. It's going to make you go blind." He said, "Mama, all I want to do is do it until I have to wear glasses." See my glasses? You see, there's not a man in here that hasn't had a doubt about his sexuality. And there's not a woman in here that has not had a thought about sex with the same person, with the same gender. You see, I don't care how many, it's normal. It's normal. And here we've hidden it all our lives. You see, you have these thoughts, you don't act on them. So, but if you have, whatever, it doesn't make a difference. The fears, the guilt, and resentments. You talk about this and with somebody else. I can take anybody in this room, I don't care how long you've been here. I can take anybody in this room to the nearest Denny's, and in 45 minutes we can take the first 7 steps, and you'll never have to take another drink. I've done it hundreds of times. People do it only because. You see, this is the way Dr. Bob did. Look on page 272 of Dr. Bob's story. He would take them into the upper room and spend 3 or 4 hours with them. And these people didn't know what we know today. And they would walk out of there with all those steps, with all those steps. So don't be afraid of this. Don't be afraid of it. Talk to your friend. Be close to one another. This is the best deal that we've ever had. If I help you take your fourth step, it certainly won't be difficult to take the fifth, will it? So you won't be able to lie too much about that, because I already know all about you. I've helped you discover it. I could write out a generic inventory, and everybody in here could sign it, and it would work real well. You know that the quickest and the easiest way to take a real fast inventory is for you to get the most despicable person in your life, and you write down every bad thing that you can think about that dude. I mean, really smear it on. Get down in the nitty gritty. Get down in the dirt. Really write about them. And then when you've written everything that you can think about that person, sign your own name. That'll be your inventory. Because you wouldn't have thought it if you hadn't done it. So the thought of us being aloof and above everybody else, we're not. We're cut from the same bolt of cloth. Certainly not to judge one another. Because you see, we don't know where that next person that we're going to judge, We don't know where they started from. See, their starting point could have been way, way back there, where, you know, education or lack of money or lack of culture, lack of character building. You see, people are not to be criticized for that, because this is where we learn to live and move and have our being. And it's right in the pit of your gut. You're wondering where God is. If you have a good feeling in the pit of your gut, you're doing God's will. If you have a nervous, knotty feeling, God ain't there. Ain't there. This is the best deal that I've ever had. And that the simplest thing that we can ever do in working this whole program is you come to a meeting and everybody you see, not just in an AA meeting, everyone you see, you do unto them as you would have them do unto you. Treat people kindly. Treat people unselfishly. Treat people kindly. You would have thought that I had resurrected, raised the cross myself, as Diane and I were riding down here, a dude cut in front of me, and I very piously said, "Go right ahead." I let him get in there, and you'd have thought I hung the moon, because I felt good. I consciously let him in, and I felt good. That little girl that I told you about, Kathy, that I wasn't able to take to her first meeting. Kathy passed away on November the 13th, 1983, with a brain tumor. We'd had her at home for almost a year and a half, with the hospice service and so forth. She taught me about life. You see, I wasn't able to take her to that banquet, but because I came here and became active in the program, I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I came here and became active in the program, Kathy got to see her dad walk on the sunny side of the street with head held high and with honesty for 19 years. And if I hadn't met you, I'd have missed it all. God bless you.